as I wait, heart of God.
Hello and welcome to the Bridge Podcast, where we talk about how to bridge what we learn on Sunday with our everyday lives. Now you can find both the Sunday content, the sermon, and the series. You can find that on newlifepacifica.com, in addition to our small group questions, our discussion questions as well. Now we have made it after 5 weeks to the last Sunday in our series on suffering, a series entitled Nonsense, The Paradox of Suffering. We've looked at sources, we've looked at questions that we ask, and now we are stopping in much the same way that Job stopped, simply letting God be God in the midst of our difficulties. I think this is a really great way to end, and I love the book of Daniel, so I love that we're dabbling in that book as well.
Yeah, originally I had planned for 4 sermons, but as we worked through it, it suddenly became apparent that to me that we needed to sort of, in a sense, collect this. Mm. And since we began by asking, why do we need a theology of suffering, to finish with an assertion that really the central pillar of our dealing with suffering as believers is to understand that we need to let God be God. And if we let God be God, he's not required to explain things. He's not required to reveal the insight. He's not required not to be mysteries. That's not part of being God.
Right. And that element's kind of been woven through most of your sermons, I think. Probably all of your sermons have touched on this aspect of the mystery of suffering, that it's unknown in the present. And in the future, perhaps we might get a glimpse as to the reason why, as with Joseph, but in other cases, we have no idea, and we can't know, as in the case of Job. And even with Job, his life experienced a marvelous restoration at the end, but for many of us, that restoration doesn't take place, at least in this life. And that's part of the mystery, part of letting God be God.
Absolutely.
Well, our first question is called Before, Not During, and this is how it's read. Woe to the man who must learn principles in the time of crisis. Ray Stedman, the author of those words, would counsel Christians to learn the principles of walking with God through suffering before the fiery trial comes. Look back on the principles you learned over the series. The problem of evil, a theology of suffering, pain redeemed by God, our grumbling, grieving, guidance, and gratitude questions, the various sources of suffering, pathways and starting points in it, and the value of lament. We've covered a lot of ground, haven't we? What stands out to you? Do you feel better prepared to handle suffering when, not if, it comes?
Read out recurrently, and I think was part of my sense that we should do this, is the fact that most of the things which are most of suffering hits us unexpectedly in some way or another.
Yeah.
We don't expect a diagnosis, we don't expect to lose our jobs, we didn't do those sorts of things. We didn't expect to bring in place. Those things happen suddenly. But nevertheless, we can prepare for that. You know, I mean, when I think about it, I'm just remembering when, just before the year 2000, we were supposed to be preparing for the end of the world, and people did all sorts of preparations. What was going to be the end of the world, and then nothing happened. But right. We will suffer in some way or another. The thing happens which will, and for that, we can prepare to And our relationship with God is the principal way in which we make those preparations, really. That our confidence in God, our knowledge of God, our understanding of God is the thing that carries us in when, in a sense, the shock comes.
Right, right. And that's really the central subject of our second question, the centrality of God. A.W. Tozer remarks that what comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. What does this mean? Do you agree? Could it be that what comes into our mind when we think about God is the most important thing about how we approach suffering? Why?
Yeah, this is this is a quote from a book called The Knowledge of the Holy, in which A.W. Tozer suggests that our vision of God, our idea of God in currently the church, he calls it in not so polite looking, which really has sacrificed the majesty, the power, the understanding of how incredible God is. And when we recognize that this incredible God surrendered everything that was incredible about his deity to come down and live here as a fully human being, and he set that aside, then that the degree to which God engaged with suffering himself in order that he might walk with us in suffering, and recognizing that God is not somewhere out there who suddenly made a mistake and we're suffering and he thinks, oh, I better do something about it now. He's part of what there are things that he permits that we wish he hadn't permitted. Sometimes he chooses to act, sometimes he doesn't choose to act. We don't know where. But once we have an all-powerful, all-loving God, and that becomes a pillar of our foundation of our life, then we get to the point where we're able to accept or begin to accept or engage with, where first of all we're able to realize that we can talk to him and how feel, but we're also going to accept that his knowledge, that he wouldn't actually do anything that wasn't that he couldn't work for the best for us.
Right. So what I hear you saying
is, so our vision of God who
Sorry,
a vision of a God who cares and loves, he does that, then becomes central to the fact that, okay, I'm going to hang on to that despite the fact I don't understand.
Yeah, so what I'm hearing you say is there's of course, an infinite complexity to the nature of God, but at least those two relevant pieces to our conception of God in suffering are, one, that he suffered first himself, and that's, of course, what we get in Jesus. And I just can't help but remember what Randy Alcorn says, maybe to in the face of some people who might question, does God really care about me because of, you know, X, Y, Z, because of ABC? And then, you know, God could simply respond, like, do these look like the hands of a God that doesn't care? I went to the cross for you. I care for you. And your suffering is not evidence of me not caring for you. My suffering is an evidence that I do care for you. And that's one element. The other element is kind of more of Job's story, where God is God and he does not, he's not obliged to respond to every little complaint that we little creatures have. He is good. He's proven himself to be good. And our role in a lot of cases is simply to trust that goodness. Our third question is a bit complicated. We've called it conflict, just like there's conflict in a storyline. And this is that third question. Randy Alcorn encourages believers to think of suffering in terms of story. What would Star Wars be without Darth Vader? The Lord of the Rings without Sauron? Our story, the only true story, has a villain too. Who is this villain, and what has the hero of our story done about it in the past? What is he doing about it in the present, and what will he do about it in the future?
Yeah, this is a really interesting question. When I first started looking at it, I'm not sure that I understand this question, but now I do. It has a dangerous aspect of it, because we could, you know, there's always this possibility you blame the devil, you blame the evil one for everything that happens. But you know, ultimately, as we discovered when we looked at the sources of suffering, yes, in the big picture, there is nothing that's bad in the world that isn't ultimately the responsibility of the evil one. Some of the things that we do, we bring upon ourselves and all those sorts of things. And so the big picture is the picture of an enemy. Then Jesus dies to vanquish. And we're in this strange place right now between the victory and, or some people say between day and VE day, when the victory's been won, but splutting of the war is still going on. And the evil hasn't given up yet, but he's been beaten.
Yeah. I mean, I think that this question kind of helps us to look behind the curtain in a way. And that's what we get at the beginning of Job, right? Where it's this conversation and God's divine counsel where for some mysterious reason, you know, Satan is invited into this space as well. And God says, look at my servant Job. What does God get excited about? There's a whole host of things that we as humans get excited about, but what does God get excited about? It's the righteousness of his servants. And then that becomes like the battlefield over which, you know, Satan is determined to destroy that which makes God most proud, which is the righteousness of his own people. So we kind of get like a peek at what's going on behind the curtain there. And then of course, the same is true as kind of like a way to frame the entire biblical story. Back in Genesis 3, it was, you know, we don't want to take responsibility away from, you know, Adam and Eve, who partook of the apple or whatever, you know, the forbidden fruit. But Satan was present in the garden as well. And equally responsible for, you know, for man's corruption to become like Satan himself. And the promise made in that same chapter is that the seed of the woman would crush the head of the serpent. And yeah, that took place 2,000 years ago. And like he received a mortal wound, and he's going to die of that wound when Jesus decides to return.
Mm.
Our final question shares this final question shares its title with the title of the sermon, Let God Be God, and it focuses on some characters from the book of Daniel. The book of Daniel is not without its villains as well. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, burned Jerusalem to the ground, executed thousands of Jews, and then carried into slavery those who remained. Read the account of how three young slaves stood up to this tyrannical world conqueror. If asked how they did it, what would they say? How might the phrase, let God be God, work its way into their answer?
Well, I told you the story, if you didn't know it already, reminded you of the story of the Meshach and Abednego on Sunday. And of course, the of the story is when Nebuchadnezzar hauls them up in front of him and says, hey, one more chance. And say, look, we don't defend ourselves. Whatever happens, we're not going to bow down and worship you or the gods that you have. And you have every confidence that you can do what you like as far as a burning fire furnace is concerned, but we believe that our God is both capable and will save us. However, even if He doesn't. He doesn't. We're still not going to bow down. We're still, because our God is God. We're going to defend you, not because we want to get somewhere. We're going to defy you because our God is God. And bow to the fact that God is God. We are mysteries. We passed and through so many of the difficulties and the mysteries and the pain and the suffering. If we allow God to be God, we know that ultimately he will do. Ultimately, he will bring us to the victory. Even if that victory is something we have to wait for eternity to experience.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's tempting to look at a story like this and to just kind of see the principle behind it of absolute, unwavering loyalty to Yahweh and faithfulness to the God of Israel, right? Mm-hmm. As demonstrated by these three people. But like what brings this story to life for me is Liz and I recently finished listening to an audiobook by Randy Alcorn called Safely Home, which follows the life of the persecuted home church in China. And it shares some really brutal moments of like the party persecuting genuine Christians and like holding them at gunpoint and saying like denounce the faith or die. And like that was a really freaky moment reading the book, but that's exactly what's happening here in Daniel chapter 3. Like it might as well be, you know, Nebuchadnezzar foaming at the mouth and like waving a pistol in their face. It's the exact same thing, except with this fiery furnace.
And as far as we can see, it's happening.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And it's our responsibility to be praying for those believers.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we've reached the end of this series. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Really. Takes what has been maybe like a children's story that we depict on flannel graph and give it a little somber tone, but a glorious one at the same time, more glorious because of how somber it is.
Now you're yourself flannel graph. There will be a number of people listening to this who have no idea what flannel graph, but I know what you're talking about.
No, I think honestly the only reason I know what it is because of how often it's made its way into sermon illustrations in a humorous way. Not that I've experienced the flannel graph personally, or if I have, I don't remember it.
I have.
Awesome. Well, if you have one, you should bring it to Sunday church sometime. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We will see you guys next week.
As I wait, heart of God.